It's The Unbelievable Truth with your host, David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. Please welcome Miles Jupp, Celia AB, Michelle Wolfe and Frankie Boyle. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth, or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Miles Jupp. Miles has moved to an isolated part of Monmouthshire in Wales. He says one drawback is that the reception isn't very good, but he hopes in time the locals will learn to tolerate him. Miles, your subject is men, adult male human beings. Off you go, Miles. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
I was delighted to get this subject to speak about, as I myself am an alpha male. Something wrong with the buzzers. Just over a third of men have at some point faked an orgasm, counterfeiting the distinctive signs of male climax, like rolling over and muttering, "Well, you can see yourself out."
Celia.
I think men fake orgasms, but I think it's a taboo, and I'm here to talk about it.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
yes.
When they're with me.
Yes, in 2012, the men's lifestyle website, askmen.com, asked 49,000 men and 1,000 women whether they'd ever faked an orgasm. 34% of men said that they'd faked it at least once in their lives, compared to 54% of women. Notably, 26% of women reported faking it every single time.
You may have noticed tonight that I'm wearing a codpiece. Codpieces take their name from the codfish, specifically inspired by the Tudor noblewoman who eyed the bulge in her gentleman's friend's trousers and remarked, "I wouldn't mind seeing one of those dipped in batter."
Michelle.
Is that true about the codpiece?
Codpiece named after codfish?
Yes.
No. Oh. No. Cod was a Middle English word for scrotum. And 16th century cod pieces were designed to emphasise the wearer's masculinity and, in some cases, create the impression of a permanent erection. That's no longer considered classy looking. Many were decorated with jewels and embroidery. What's wrong with that? Nice decorated stiffy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's just a deck peck, isn't it? Then they got the embroiderer involved.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if I got a deck peck and someone had gone to the trouble of having jewels and lace... Yeah, perhaps I'd be okay with it.
Do send in your bejeweled dick pics. And we'll share them on Radio 4's Instagram page.
This is where the craze starts.
In certain tribes of Central Australia, it is customary for one man to greet another by shaking him by the penis. If the other person presses their middle finger hard on the underside of your glands, it means they're a Freemason.
Frankie.
All over Australia, surely.
No, you're absolutely right. That is true. Male members of the Aboriginal Walpiri tribe in Australia traditionally greet each other at ceremonial occasions by shaking penises. This practice, known as ubara, involves men placing their penises in the host's hand upon meeting. The tradition of ubara is discussed by former diplomat Andy Scott in his book One Kiss or Two, The Art and Science of Saying Hello. In which book he states, to refuse a penis was a sign of hostility. So, Miles.
If you're an Orthodox rabbi, you're supposed to thank God every day for not making you a woman. Although I should point out that these days you don't need God to make you a woman. You can simply order one online and then have a yodel driver park up outside your house illegally before leaving them with your neighbour.
Celia.
I think that's true, that they thank God every day for not being a woman.
You're absolutely right. And not... and it's not just for rabbis. A traditional Jewish prayer for men reads, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has not created me a woman." Written by male rabbis nearly 2,000 years ago, the blessing is recited at the beginning of the daily morning prayers. Women, on the other hand, recite the following line: "Blessed are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has made me according to your will."
My favourite perfume is Obsession for Men by Calvin Klein. It's got a delightful odour of jasmine and ylang ylang. The only downside is that it does attract jaguars, who will travel hundreds of miles to attack anyone spraying it, a small but significant factor in the final collapse of Debenhams. Shorter men are, it almost goes without saying, inherently difficult to trust.
Although... Frankie.
That's true.
Not according to any survey we find, but, you know.
Get on it, boffins.
Although taller men are more likely to be guilty of financial misconduct.
Frankie.
That's true.
No, that's not true either. Though a US survey suggests that someone who is 6 feet tall earns, on average, nearly $166,000 more during a 30-year career than someone who is 5 foot 5 inches tall. But then if you think of them being paid, you know, per inch, then they're on and roughly the same rate.
Like a sex worker. Yeah.
Miles.
Men are 5 times more likely than women to be struck by lightning, although this is not surprising, given that women are far more likely to notice it's not the right weather for golf.
Michelle.
5 times more likely to get struck by lightning?
You're absolutely right. That's true. Yes. The explanation being that male-dominated leisure activities, such as fishing, camping, boating and golf, were responsible for the majority of lightning-related deaths each year.
I'm glad lightning is killing outdoor enthusiasts.
I have to say, I think it may be our only weapon against the scourge of golf. You know, it's there could be no surer sign that God hates golf. And that's the end of Miles's lecture. And at the end of that round, Miles, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that Obsession for Men by Calvin Klein attracts jaguars. In 2010, a group of scientists attempting to draw cheetahs to camera traps at the Bronx Zoo in New York tried various scents to lure the big cats, including Estee Lauder's Beautiful, which detained the cats for 2 seconds, and Revlon's Charlie, which detained them for 15.5 seconds. But after spraying Calvin Klein's Obsession for Men, the animals stayed in place for a whole 11 minutes. News of the discovery spread, and when the scent was tested on jaguars in the Guatemalan jungle, the scent excited male and female jaguars equally, and the experiment helped capture some seldom-seen jaguar mating rituals.
Be a good way to go out, wouldn't it? Just cover yourself with Calvin Klein's Obsession and walk into the jaguar enclosure. Maybe that's how Attenborough should go.
It's what he would have wanted. Just... And that means, Miles, you've scored 1 point. OK, we turn now to Celia AB. Celia moved from France to Birmingham before deciding to become a comedian. It was that or give in to despair. Celia, your subject is sculptures, three-dimensional works of art typically made by carving or shaping stone, wood, clay or metal that are sometimes abstract or, in the case of statues, representative. Off you go, Celia.
Throughout history, every famous piece of sculpture has been vandalized. A statue in France has had its penis stolen so often, it's been given a detachable one that's only attached for special occasions.
Frankie.
That sounds true.
It is true. Well done, yes. In the seaside town of Arcachon in southwestern France, a statue of the Greek hero Hercules has a detachable penis which is attached for official ceremonies and public events.
Wouldn't you feel bad if you had an event and they didn't put the penis on?
Oh, I mean, you'd be mortified, wouldn't you? So just, it was my wedding day, and you can see in all the pictures, the cock's not there.
The male Picasso octopus creates 3D abstract sculptures out of oyster shells as part of its mating ritual.
I believe that's true about octopus. Octopi?
Octopi.
It's not octopi, actually.
Is it octopus?
It's not Latin. It's octopodes, or... That's not a joke, it's true. the most common plural would just be octopuses.
Okay, so, yeah. Well, then I think it's true about the octopuses.
No, it's not, no.
And male sandcastle fish, aquarium fish from Malawi, hold two-week sandcastle building competitions to attract a female. One of the most famous statues in the West was commissioned in 1922 by French millionaires Liberty Letizier and gifted to her former lover, U.S. President Herbert Hoover, great-grandfather of Henry Le Hoover. However, when the 200-meter-high Statue of Liberty was assembled in the New York Harbor, the head of the statue was placed 2 feet off-center, making her appear more French as it looked like she was leaning in for la bise. And following a generous donation from the Bassett Ice Cream Company, a giant ice cream cone was added to her right hand.
Miles.
I think when the Statue of Liberty was assembled, they did have to adjust the head positioning.
That fact is absolutely true. They didn't adjust it because it wasn't until the Statue of Liberty's restoration in the 1980s that it was discovered that the statue's head had been placed 2 feet off-center when it was originally constructed between 1876 and 1886. So it was misaligned for 100 years. And it was found to be the cause of several structural issues that the statue had faced over the years. A further issue for restorers was the fact that the entire statue had been insulated using asbestos, obliging them to wear moon suits with built-in breathing apparatus. So that's some horrible metaphor, isn't it? The Statue of Liberty full of asbestos. The hidden toxicity of supposed freedom.
Feels about accurate right now, but...
Following the creation of his masterpiece, David, Michelangelo's reputation as a sculptor was so great that in 1494, following a heavy snowfall, the ruler of Florence offered him a commission to sculpt a snowman.
Frankie.
That sounds like the thing some Florentine prince would do.
It is. You're absolutely right. Yep. Recorded by the 16th century art historian Giorgio Vasari that, quote, one winter, when a great deal of snow fell in Florence, Piero de' Medici had Michelangelo make in his courtyard a statue of snow, which was very beautiful. I don't think it was like a carrot for the nose affair, but it probably had a, you know, a realistic penis on it, for example.
Covered in jewels.
Yeah.
Despite a wealthy upbringing in her native Greece, sculptor Iliana Dimitriou is renowned not only for her heroic nude sculptures of lower-class labourers, but for the intense, often physical relationships she'd had with many of her subjects. Of her training in London, Dimitriou says, I came from Greece, I had a thirst for knowledge, I studied sculptures at St. Martin's College. Revenge sculpture has long been with us. A Detroit man bought a house directly opposite his ex-wife and installed a giant bronze middle finger sculpture on the balcony facing her home. Because nothing says, I am over someone, than going through the complicated mortgage process and hiring contractors. And that's all on sculptures.
Miles.
I think the last one is true, the big sculpture flipping the bird in Detroit.
You're absolutely right, it is. Alan Markovitz, a strip club owner from Michigan, specially bought a house next to his ex-wife's in order to install a 12-foot, $7,000 bronze statue of a raised middle finger on a balcony facing her property. His daughter, Lenka, wrote on Twitter, how psychotic do you have to be to buy the house directly next to your ex-wife and then put a statue up like that? Real classy, Alan. And that's the end of Celia's lecture. And at the end of that round, Celia, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that aquarium fish from Malawi hold two-week sandcastle building competitions to attract a female. And that means, Celia, that you've scored 1 point. Ancient Greek male statues had small penises, as small penises were considered a sign of a cultured, important individual. And that is both still true and correct. The reason ancient Roman statues are often headless is because they were designed with removable heads, so the head could be replaced if the person depicted fell out of favour, which helps explain why the new statue of Sir David Attenborough outside BBC Broadcasting House is wearing a tracksuit and a Jim Will Fix It badge. Next up is Michelle Wolfe. Michelle, your subject is theft, the act of dishonestly taking something that belongs to someone else. Off you go, Michelle.
Due to his habit of breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night, St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus, is the patron saint of thieves. There was more theft or burglarization, as we call it in the U.S., in the 18th century than at any other time in human history, and thieves began to specialize. Someone who stole clothes from your washing line was known as a frock filcher. Someone who stole your silver was a clanknapper. And a person who stole gold jewelry was known as a pinchbeck. Someone who stole people's land was known as British.
Frankie. I sort of feel one of them must be true. So the, is it the cutlery one, the clink pincher?
The clanknapper.
Clanknapper.
You're absolutely right. Oh. Yep. In the 18th century, a clanknapper was a thief that specialised in stealing silverware.
In Switzerland, the theft of cheese was a capital offence, so Swiss cheese thieves became highly skilled at removing small balls of cheese from a larger block, so the holes they left looked like air bubbles.
Celia.
I think that's true. It was a capital offence.
No. The theft of cheese has never been a capital offence in Switzerland, though in early 19th century Britain, under the Bloody Code, you could face the death sentence for stealing sheep cheese, goods worth more than 12 pence, and stealing from a shipwreck or a rabbit warren.
In 19th century Ireland, the theft of a single potato often resulted in a death sentence. And in Peking...
Frankie.
That sounds like the British.
No, that's not happening. While the theft of a single potato could lead to imprisonment during the 19th century, particularly during the Great Famine, I mean, particularly during the Great Famine, that's when they really decide to crack down on it. There's one time I will not have someone steal a potato. It's when they would otherwise starve to death. No, imprisonment, but it did not result in a death sentence.
And in Peking, China, you could face the death penalty for stealing a Pekingese dog. Thieves have always been thought of as lower class, hence the expression common thief. So in the 1860s, for the protection of well-bred, upper-class, light-fingered members of society, the term kleptomaniac was invented to prevent them being classed as common thieves or robbers. The two most regularly stolen road signs in America are those for the towns of Bitch, Idaho, and Shitting, Nebraska, with my own much-stolen hometown sign of Asswipe, Pennsylvania, coming a credible third. In 1995, two middle-aged men robbed a Pittsburgh bank at gunpoint with lemon juice on their faces. As they'd heard that lemon juice is used to make invisible ink, they assumed it was... They assumed it would make their faces invisible on security cameras.
Frankie.
That has to be true.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. In 1995, MacArthur Wheeler and Clifton Earl Johnson robbed two Pittsburgh banks at gunpoint and were immediately caught due to their failure to wear disguises, opting instead to cover their faces with lemon juice in the belief it would make them invisible on security cameras. When MacArthur Wheeler was arrested at midnight the same day, he allegedly said, "But I wore the juice."
Singapore has the second lowest rate of burglary in the world. According to their Ministry of Justice, it's the result of their hands-on approach to petty theft. The country with the lowest rate of theft is Saudi Arabia, which they attribute to their hands-off approach.
Thank you, Michelle. And at the end of that round, Michelle, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that St. Nicholas or Santa Claus is the patron saint of thieves, specifically repentant thieves. He's also the patron saint of pawnbrokers, prostitutes, unmarried women, prisoners, separated spouses, and children. And it's quite the brief. And the second truth is that in Imperial China, you could face the death penalty for stealing a Pekingese dog. Queen Victoria was gifted one such stolen Pekingese dog, thought to be the first in the UK, which was looted from the Summer Palace near Beijing during the Second Opium War in 1860. As a result, the Queen named the dog Looty. And the third truth is that in the 1860s, the term kleptomaniac was invented to prevent the upper class from being classed as common thieves or robbers. Though the term kleptomania, describing the compulsive urge to steal, was in fact coined in 1816 by Swiss doctor André Matte, it wasn't used in the UK and America until the 1860s when department stores started to become popular leisure destinations and incidents of shoplifting increased significantly, especially amongst women, some of them middle or upper class. Doctors often diagnosed these women as kleptomaniacs, suffering from shopping fever or hysteria, and framing their behaviour as a medical condition rather than a crime. In contrast, working-class individuals who committed similar acts were labelled as robbers or thieves and punished accordingly. And that means, Michelle, you've scored 3 points. It's now the turn of Frankie Boyle. Your subject, Frankie, is martial arts, any of several fighting styles which originated chiefly in Japan, Korea, and China, and which are typically practiced as a sport or for exercise. Off you go, Frankie.
Let's look at some of the many misconceptions about martial arts. Jiu-jitsu cannot be practiced by people of any other major religion. Kung fu is not a specific art, but rather a term for any practice requiring discipline, such as tea making or embroidery. And despite the name, Cornish wrestling is not a martial art at all, but merely slang for incest. Research shows that joining a martial arts club rarely leads to great friendships. Usually you end up sitting in the back of a van with a pocket full of throwing stars thinking, when Steve asked if I wanted to meet his kids, I didn't know we were going to have to abduct them first. Chuck Norris once said that as a child he thought he saw a superhero, but it turned out to be just a depressed clown throwing himself off a tower block.
Miles.
I think that is true, and I also think it's the sort of thing that you would remember forever, Frankie, having read it.
No, it's not true, because it's also the sort of thing Frankie would invent.
Jean-Claude Van Damme's first role was credited as Gay Karate Man. He demanded that the credit be changed on the grounds that he was actually a kickboxer.
Celia.
Is that true?
Van Damme's first role?
Yeah.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Yep. The first credited film role of Jean-Claude Van Damme, or The Muscles from Brussels, was in a 1984 comedy, Monaco Forever, where Van Damme's character is listed in the credits as Gay Karate Man.
Boxer Tyson Fury had to change his nickname from the Gypsy King as people kept turning up to his fights expecting to hear flamenco music. Here's a little rhyme I used to remember all the famous people who have trained in the martial arts. Russell Harty did karate. The Band of Who all did kung fu. Pope John Paul did none at all. Sheryl Crow does taekwondo. And the disgraced 1960s former conservative minister John Profumo did sumo.
Michelle.
I think Pope John Paul did none at all.
Do you know, that wasn't one of the truths that Frankie was given, but it is true. It's an inadvertent truth. Bonus point there. Though sporty in his youth, John Paul II did not take part in martial arts.
Britain's Anglican clergy are offered martial arts training by their union. A vicar from Hadley in Suffolk competed at UFC 24, and afterwards his congregation held a week-long fete in the village to help him buy a new spleen. The Catholic Church does not provide any martial arts training for priests, but does now offer altar boys a taser and a head start. The annual World Octopus Wrestling Championships were held in Washington and televised during the 1960s. Contestants generally came from local hospitals, and the event itself was largely a form of euthanasia. This inspired a Philadelphia scientist to stage an experiment where he wrestled a whale. And it's thanks to his selfless work that we know about the whale's inability to distinguish between wrestling and foreplay. All American presidents have been proficient in at least one fighting form. Richard Nixon was a karate black belt whose campaign slogan in 1972 was, "Vote for me, I can crush a man's head like a beer can." Teddy Roosevelt's party piece was to kill a cow with a single kick, prompting onlookers to ask, "What kind of party is this?" And Abraham Lincoln was a renowned wrestler who offered to settle the Civil War in single combat against the Confederate champion, a ferocious transvestite known as Antebellum.
Thank you, Frankie. And at the end of that round, Frankie, you've managed to smuggle four truths past the rest of the panel. The first of which is that kung fu is not a specific art, but rather a term for any practice requiring discipline, such as tea making and embroidery. The second truth is that Britain's Anglican clergy are offered martial arts training by their union. Representing God was said by the union to be more dangerous than working as a doctor or a probation officer, with many of the assaults taking place in church grounds or vicarages. The third truth is that the annual World Octopus Wrestling Championships were held in Washington and televised during the 1960s. Teams of three divers would descend to depths of 30 to 50 feet in an attempt to wrestle an octopus to the surface. The team that captured the largest octopus would be declared the winner and awarded a trophy. And the fourth truth is that Abraham Lincoln was a formidable wrestler and is said to have won over 300 matches, losing only once in a period of 12 years. Lincoln's reputation as a skilled wrestler is believed to have contributed to his election as president in 1860. In 1992, Lincoln was posthumously inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. And that means, Frankie, you've scored 4 points. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with minus 1 point, we have Celia AB. In third place, with no points, it's Miles Jupp. In second place, with 4 points, it's Michelle Wolf. And in first place, with an unassailable 6 points, it's this week's winner, Frankie Boyle. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Miles Jupp, Michelle Wolf, Celia AB and Frankie Boyle. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.
And that was the last of